You know, it's that classic tech nightmare. You've identified a problem, you've thrown top-tier resources at it, and you've locked down, like, every conceivable vulnerability.
Oh yeah, the illusion of safety.
Right. So you boot up your freshly hardened 32-gigabyte GCP dev box, completely confident it is never, ever breaking again,
Yeah.
and then it just dies.
Just completely flat lines.
Exactly. So welcome to the deep dive. Today, we are opening up the logs on a literal technological murder mystery based on a brilliant developer blog post titled, "My Server Died Again. This time it was Cursor." Our mission for this deep dive is to look at the autopsy of this specific machine to explore why simply, throwing more hardware at an infrastructure problem rarely solves it.
Right, because it really doesn't.
It doesn't. And we're going to uncover how modern development tools silently hoard system resources right under our noses. So, yeah, it's a wild ride.
It really is a fascinating postmortem because, I mean, server crashes are an everyday reality for you if you're working in tech, but the specific anatomy of this crash, it really highlights a massive blind spot in how modern software handles memory allocation.
Yeah.
It basically forces you to rethink some very basic assumptions about system stability and, the tools we just blindly run on a daily basis.
Okay, let's unpack this. We really need to lay out the crime scene first because the context here is critical. In part three of the author's ongoing DevBox saga, they were initially running a 16-gigabyte machine, and that one died an agonizing death due to a Chrome crash loop.
Which is sadly not surprising at all.
Right, classic Chrome.
Right.
So the author applied 12 different hardening measures. They upgraded the instance to an E2 Heim M4 with 32 gigs of RAM, and they deployed a custom memory watchdog script. I mean, it was supposed to be bulletproof.
On paper, yeah, it looks solid.
But here we are looking at a dead server. And the symptoms are highly specific. When the author attempted an SSH connection, it timed out right during the banner exchange.
Yeah, and that specific timeout, that tells us exactly what state the machine is in.
How so? Like, what does that actually mean under the hood?
Well, hanging at the banner exchange means the kernel network stack is actually still alive. It's acknowledging the TCP handshake.
Okay, so it's not totally dead.
Right, it's breathing.
Yeah.
But spawning the actual SWED worker process for the session, that requires allocating user space memory.
Ah, I see.
And since the user space is completely frozen, the allocation just hangs indefinitely. So you can knock on the door and the house acknowledges the knock, but the system literally lacks the memory to, walk over and open it.
Wow, okay. I'm looking at this from an infrastructure perspective, and 32 gigabytes is a massive footprint for a single user dev box.
Oh, absolutely.
Even if the user space is frozen, how does a machine with that much memory just vanish into the ether? I mean, upgrading from 16 to 32 gigs should have provided an enormous buffer, right?
You'd think so. But if we connect this to the bigger picture, it comes down to a fundamental principle of computing that developers often try to ignore out of convenience. And that is, memory is basically a gas.
A gas, like it just expands.
Exactly. If you have an unbounded process running in the background without strict groups or resource limits, it will simply expand to fill whatever container you put it in.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so it doesn't matter if you provision 16 gigs, 32 gigs, or a terabyte. That 32 gigabyte hardware upgrade didn't solve the underlying architectural problem at all. It merely bought the author a few more hours before the inevitable collapse.
It just gave the leak a bigger room to fill before the oxygen ran out. That's
Yeah.
wild. So, since the machine was completely unresponsive, the author had to rely on the virtual machine's serial console to see the last things the server logged before it died.
Which is always a fun forensics exercise.
Well, yeah. And the investigation starts with a pretty painful irony regarding their monitoring setup.
Ah, yes. The GCP ops agent logs.
Yes. So, after fighting through some expired GCP auth tokens, the author finally gets into the serial console and finds the GCP ops agent going absolutely berserk.
Right. The very tool meant to save the system.
Exactly. This is the official agent installed specifically to monitor the system's health and prevent crashes. But it is stuck in an infinite spam loop of permission denied errors.
Yeah, that's brutal.
It's dropping over 1,800 metrics per batch. And every single time it fails to write a metric, it generates massive error logs. The very last line in the system log before total silence is from system resolve stating, quote, "Under memory pressure, flushing caches."
You can just see the cascading failure happening in real time there.
Yeah, it's like watching a slow-motion car crash.
Completely. The ops agent was basically lacking the proper IAM permissions to write its metrics out to the cloud, but because it couldn't send the data out, those dropped metrics likely just queued up in memory.
Oh, so it's just holding on to them.
Right. And the resulting error spam saturated the disk I.O. as it frantically tried to write to Journald.
It's like installing a state-of-the-art fire suppression system. But when it detects a spark, a valve gets stuck. And instead of putting out the fire, it violently ruptures the main water line, flooding the building and shorting out the electrical grid.
That maps perfectly to the system behavior, actually, and is a massive takeaway for you listening right now.
Yeah, pay attention to this part.
Monitoring tools require correct permissions and hard resource limits just as strictly as the applications they are monitoring. I mean, without the correct IAM roles, a lightweight daemon transforms into a massive resource burden.
It becomes the villain.
Literally. The error logging consumed precious disk I.O. and memory, which completely accelerated the crash. That last log from System Resolved, desperately flushing its DNS caches. That was just the system's last-ditch effort to survive the memory pressure created by the monitoring tool.
Man, that is rough. But the ops agent, as destructive as it was acting, wasn't the main culprit here, right?
No, it just sped things up.
Yeah, it accelerated the death, but the author had that custom memory watchdog running, and those logs captured the real killer. Let's look at the timeline, because the escalation is just wild.
It really jumps up quickly.
It does. So it's 01.39 UTC, which is about 8 hours into the session. The server is sitting comfortably at 87% memory usage. Claude Code is running, taking up about 1 gigabyte of RAM. That's perfectly normal behavior.
Yeah, completely expected for a local AI agent footprint. No red flags there.
Right. But fast forward to 09.12 UTC, which is 15 hours in. Memory usage has crept up to 89%. Suddenly, the watchdog logs show 5 distinct processes, and each one is eating between 2 and 2.7 gigabytes of RAM.
And that's where the panic sets in.
For real. 1 minute later, at 09.13 UTC, total memory hits 94%, and the swap space hits 88%. The watchdog tries to act. It violently kills Chrome to free up space, but the system is already in an unrecoverable death spiral.
It was way too late.
Way too late. Out of 32 gigabytes of RAM, about 20 gigabytes were consumed, and those 5 mysterious processes were holding nearly half of it.
I mean, jumping from 89% to 94% in 60 seconds isn't a slow leak anymore.
No, that's an explosion.
Exactly. That is a rapid allocation spike hitting a system that is already severely degraded by the ops agent issue.
So the author obviously assumed the culprit was Claude Code. They'd seen it consume a gigabyte or two earlier in the day, so the math makes sense, right? 5 sessions of Claude eating 2.7 gigs each.
It's a very logical assumption.
But here's where it gets really interesting. Looking at the actual watchdog logs, process names are everything. The command field didn't say Claude, it logged Node.
Yep, node.js.
Those 5 massive processes were actually the remote server for Cursor, the AI code editor.
And this is where we have to dissect Cursor's SSH remote mode architecture, because it's super important to understand why this happened.
Yeah, please break this down for me.
When you connect VS Code or Cursor to a remote server, it isn't just tunneling text over SSH. It spins up an entire headless backend dedicated to your workspace. And it spawns several distinct node workers to handle different responsibilities.
Okay. I mean, I can understand a remote editor needing some RAM for my active files.
Mm-hmm.
But 5 separate node processes eating 15 gigabytes collectively, what are they caching the entire Git history of the project?
Honestly. In some cases, almost literally. Let's break down those workers.
Yeah, let's hear it.
First up, you have servermain.js. This manages your undo history and file caches. It essentially never drops that memory because, well, you expect infinite instant undo capability across your session.
Oh, right. You don't want to hit undo and just get nothing.
Exactly. Second is the extension host, which basically sandboxes every extension you have installed into one massive process.
Okay, and if you have a ton of extensions, that's going to get heavy.
Very heavy. Third is the file watcher, which maintains an in-memory tree of your project using Inodify. If you have a large project, that tree is enormous.
Okay, so undo history, extensions, file watching. Heavy, sure, but kind of expected. What are the other two?
The fourth is the SUPI host. This one manages your terminal sessions. Crucially, it never truncates your scroll buffers.
Wait, never?
Never. If you leave a build script running or an NPM install spitting out verbose logs for an hour, every single line of that output just sits in RAM indefinitely.
Oh, man. I've definitely left Webpack dev servers running for days without clearing the terminal, so that's just sitting in memory.
Yep, just eating up your RAM. And the fifth process is the server. This is often the heaviest one.
What does that one do?
It holds the abstract syntax tree, the AST of your TypeScript or JavaScript project, completely in memory.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it constantly reparses your code as you type to provide instant autocomplete and type checking across thousands of files, but it almost never shrinks its memory footprint once it expands.
Okay, but even with an AST in memory, why does it grow so out of control? I get why it allocates memory initially, but why does a node process go from 400 megabytes to 2.7 gigabytes over 15 hours without ever giving anything back to the operating system?
To understand that, you really have to look at the underlying JavaScript engine V8. V8 uses a strategy called lazy garbage collection.
Lazy garbage collection. Okay.
Right. It optimizes for throughput rather than memory efficiency.
Walk me through the mechanics of that. Why does V8 actively choose to hold on to memory? Like, what's the benefit?
Well, garbage collection requires CTU cycles. In V8, a major garbage collection, what they call a full mark and sweep, is a stop the world event.
Meaning everything halts.
Literally everything. It literally pauses the execution of your JavaScript.
Mm.
If Cursor paused your typing for 200 milliseconds every few seconds to clean up memory, the editor would feel incredibly laggy and unresponsive.
Ah, so to keep the UI buttery smooth, it just refuses to clean up.
Precisely. It's like, think of a warehouse manager who refuses to stop operations to sweep the floors until the empty pallets are literally touching the ceiling.
Because stopping to sweep means stopping the forklifts.
Exactly. By default, V8 has a heap limit of about 4 gigabytes on a 64-bit system. It will not execute a major garbage collection unless it feels severe memory pressure. But to V8, pressure means getting perilously close to its own 4-gigabyte limit.
Let me make sure I'm mapping this correctly. The author upgraded the GCP instance to 32 gigabytes. The server itself had plenty of room.
Tons of room.
But those five individual V8 processes didn't know or care about the server's total RAM. They only cared about their internal 4-gigabyte heaps.
Exactly right. The author notes there was no max old space size flag passed to the node processes to artificially lower that heap limit.
So they just ran wild.
Yep. So over 15 hours, each of those five Cursor processes started small, did their work, created dead objects in memory, and instead of cleaning them up, just requested more pages from the OS. They relentlessly grew to 2.7 gigabytes each. It is a slow memory leak by design.
That is wild. The engine is deliberately hoarding memory to avoid stuttering, completely blind to the fact that it's suffocating the host machine.
It's a very tunnel-visioned approach to performance.
But you know, knowing how the server was murdered is only half the battle. Now we need to look at how the author stopped it from happening again. And the fixes here are honestly a masterclass in pragmatic system administration.
They really are. They address the problem at three entirely different layers of the stack.
Let's lay them out. Fix number one was handling the GCP ops agent. The author finally gave it the correct IAM roles, specifically the metric writer and log writer roles.
Which is such a simple fix when you think about it.
Right, and that immediately stopped the permission denied spam, which allowed the daemon to flush its memory queues and stopped the disk I/O from thrashing.
You fix the fire alarm so it stops bursting the water pipes.
Right, and then fix number two was implementing Watchdog V2. The author realized their old thresholds were just way too generous.
Yeah, waiting until 92% is just asking for trouble.
Exactly. By the time the old watchdog tried to act at 92% memory, the system swap was already at 88%. So the new rules are much tighter. It warns and logs at 75%. It sacrifices Google Chrome at 80%.
Sorry, Chrome.
Yeah, Chrome's got to go. And crucially, it sends a kill signal to any node process using more than 1 gigabyte of RAM at 85%.
Catching it at 85% is arguably the most critical adjustment in this entire saga.
Why is that specific number so important?
Because when you rely on the Linux OMAD of memory killer or a custom script running at 95%, you are usually way too late. Once the physical RAM fills up, Linux starts aggressively moving pages of memory to the swap drive.
Which causes thrashing, right?
Exactly. The system starts spending 99% of its CPU cycles just swapping pages back and forth between disk and RAM. And when thrashing occurs, the kernel is so overloaded with disk I/O that it can't even allocate the necessary resources to evaluate and execute your kill script.
Wow, so the script that's supposed to save you can't even run.
Right. By acting at 85% before swap saturation, the watchdog ensures the kernel still has enough breathing room to cleanly execute the sig term.
That makes perfect sense. It's like leaving yourself a fire escape.
Yeah.
But the third fix is the one I really want to dig into because it's kind of crazy.
Oh, the memory guard.
Yes, the cursor memory guard. So the author created a cron job that runs every 5 minutes. It searches for any node process eating too much RAM and just sends it a sig term, a kill command.
Just takes it out.
I look at this from a developer workflow perspective, and it sounds insane. You're violently killing the back end of the code editor mid-session? Doesn't that completely ruin the state of the workspace?
What's fascinating here is that in a traditional monolithic architecture, yes, it would be absolutely disastrous. You'd lose everything.
Right.
But this is where the author leverages Cursor's specific architecture against itself. Cursor's remote setup, which it inherits directly from VS Code Server, is fundamentally stateless and designed around the assumption of network failure.
Oh, so it expects to be disconnected.
Exactly. The UI state, your open tabs, your unsaved text, your cursor position, all of that is held locally on your laptop's Electron client. The remote server is really just an RPC worker processing commands.
So when you kill it.
When that cron job kills the massive node process, it isn't destructive at all. The local client instantly detects the drop connection, shows a brief reconnecting banner, and spins up a brand new low-memory node process on the server. You are back to coding in 2 seconds, and you've lost zero work.
That is a brilliant hack.
Yeah.
Because V8 refuses to do its own garbage collection, the author is just taking it out back and replacing it with a fresh instance.
Yep.
It forces the system to start over with an empty heap.
It is the ultimate brute force garbage collection, and it's a vital lesson for infrastructure design. Reconnectable, stateless architectures allow for incredibly aggressive, self-healing memory management.
Because the cost of failure is so low.
Exactly. If your remote environment is brittle and requires manual intervention to restore state, you are entirely at the mercy of the application's internal memory management. But if your system is designed to seamlessly reconnect, you can use that resilience as a weapon against memory bloat. You can ruthlessly terminate misbehaving processes because the recovery cost is practically zero.
It really changes the way you look at uptime entirely. So let's distill this. If you are listening to this and you're managing cloud instances or even just a heavy local dev environment, what are the core actionable takeaways you need to pull from this deep dive?
There are a few big ones.
First, audit your monitoring tools. Daemons need correct IAM permissions and strict resource limits via C groups. A starved monitoring tool will try to log its failures, and those logs will silently eat your disk I/O and memory.
Yes, absolutely.
Second, verify the exact process names in your logs before assigning blame. The author almost went down a huge rabbit hole debugging Claude when the actual command was node. Assuming you know the culprit based on past behavior is the fastest way to waste hours of debugging.
It happens to the best of us.
It really does. And third, leverage stateless architectures. If an application can gracefully recover from being terminated, don't be afraid to automate its destruction when it hoards resources.
Those are all excellent system administration practices. But, you know, this entire autopsy points to a much deeper, more systemic issue regarding the tools we use to build software today.
Yeah. Where do you see this heading?
Think about the core dynamic we just uncovered. We have default development engines, like V8, explicitly designed to defer garbage collection indefinitely to maintain UI throughput. They're operating under the assumption that 4 gigabytes of memory per process is completely acceptable overhead.
Which is wild on its own.
It is. Now, couple that architecture with the massive rise of AI-assisted coding tools like Cursor, Claude, or Copilot.
Right. Tools that inherently require massive contextual awareness. They need to see everything.
Exactly. AI tools don't just read the file you're currently working on. They need to analyze your entire repository. They parse enormous abstract syntax trees, index thousands of files, and hold massive vectors in memory just to provide contextually accurate autocomplete suggestions.
So they're just memory hogs by nature.
Yeah, and think about the cycle. These tools write code faster, which creates larger, more complex code bases, which in turn requires the AI to hold even larger ASTs in memory to understand what it just helped you build.
It's an exponential feedback loop. The AI helps you write more code, so the AI needs more memory to read the code it just wrote.
And because engines like Node and V8 rely on lazy garbage collection, they will happily hoard that memory until the underlying server collapses. I mean, we are entering an era where development tools require more resources than the production applications they are being used to build.
That is a crazy paradigm shift.
It is. As an industry, we aren't just silently tolerating software bloat because hardware is cheap. We're actively accelerating it by relying on AI architectures that demand massive, persistent memory footprints to function. So the question becomes, are we okay with this trade-off?
Wow. It's a sobering thought. You provision a 32-gigabyte dev box thinking you're building a fortress against instability. But the threat isn't an external workload pushing the server to its limits. The threat is the very editor you use to write your code, slowly filling the halls with an expanding, unbounded memory footprint until the kernel simply suffocates. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. We'll see you next time.